Now, the second hour of the show today is a little different from the norm because we are setting aside our usual Wednesday features to give this hour entirely over to the story of one family's desperate fight to save a daughter's life and of the remarkable campaign and the medical breakthroughs that resulted from that fight, which will save other patients going forward. I'm talking, of course, about the story of Jenna Lowe, our lead SA youth hero, the founder of the Get Me to 21 campaign. It's been more than 4 years since Jenna lost her life, but the legacy of that campaign continues to be an absolute game changer for thousands of other patients. And Jenna's tigress of a mom, Gabby Lowe, has recently published her book, Get Me to 21, The Jenna Lowe Story, published by MF Books. It is a gut-wrenching read, extraordinary, beautiful, sad, but also filled with hope. It is the story of what they went through fighting for Jenna's life, and also a reflection on her legacy and what has been achieved because of that fight. It's wonderful to have both Gabby and her husband Stuart with us today in front of the audience. And I must also just say a big thank you to the live studio audience members who've joined us here. Great to have you with us this afternoon, and thank you for joining us. We are going to talk about Jenna in sickness and in health. We're going to talk about your own personal fight for her health care, but we're also going to talk about the bigger picture, the continual challenge of finding donor organs for those who are desperately needing them, and about breakthroughs. I don't know if breakthroughs is the right word, but the legacy of the improvements in access to healthcare for other patients suffering with the same illness. So all of that to come in this hour. Before we do any of that, though, Gabby, I'd love to start by asking you to read from the book and to read from the very beautiful and moving prologue of the book, just to set the scene.
Thanks, Pippa. Thanks for having us here. The prologue, Get Me to 21. It's been 3 long, excruciating years since you died, Jen. I know I have to tell your story, but it is overwhelming. I'm immobilized by the enormity of it, and I can't seem to start. Help me, Jen. How do I ever do you justice? How can I find the courage to relive it? But how can I not? I have such a deep sense that your story needs to be told, to help me make sense of the suffering, to help integrate your loss into our lives, to honor your incredible legacy and celebrate the depth of the human spirit. I'm on the beach. The sun is setting like a large red orb, and my heart is aching. Warm air gently caresses my skin. I'm dizzy with the smell of salty air, and my face is streaked with tears of grief. I sway gently back and forth, hugging my body as I bury my toes deeper into the sand. I search the horizon, hoping to feel you, to hear you, when a single white feather floats to the sand. I'm right here, you whisper. I'm all around you. Simply tell the story. Here it is, the brutal truth in all its terrible beauty.
It is brutal and it is so beautiful. Gabby, thank you for starting us off with that reading today. And after this short break, we are going to talk about Jenna's illness, to talk about the Get Me to 21 campaign, and to talk about what has changed in the wake of that campaign. I know there are many, many people listening today who were incredibly, profoundly moved by Jenna's story. I know how our listeners responded when they learned of her loss. To them, if you've got a message that you would like to leave for Gabby and Stuart, you're very welcome to leave a voice note on 072-567-1567. You're also very welcome to call in on 021-446-0567 or to send your thoughts in an SMS to 31567.
You're with Cape Talk. This is Pippa Hudson on Lunch.
Right, it's 2:15 and our conversation continues around the story of Jenna Lowe. Get Me to 21, The Jenna Lowe Story is the name of the book recently published by her mom, Gabby Lowe, who we're so delighted to have with us today, as well as Jenna's dad, Stuart. Gabby, before we talk about Jenna's illness, I'd love to talk about Jenna in health, because she was a really extraordinary young woman.
She was, and she was that right from the start. I do go back in times. The book starts with the call, the day we got the call, but I do talk about Jen and her whole growing up years. But an extraordinary young thing right from the start, she was. She was very bright. She had a practically full vocabulary by the age of 18 months, which I thought was normal because she was my first child. And a social conscience and a gentleness, but wisdom right from the start. She wrote a book when she was 8 that was published, 8 years old, called The Magic Busy Tree, and weirdly enough, it was the story of a young forest girl who steps on a thorn and becomes ill, Mm-hmm. And it's a 10-chapter little book about how this forest girl is trying to find a cure. So that was pretty bizarre. She was very shy when she was young, wouldn't look an adult in the eye. And slowly as she kind of learned to read, actually, and then found writing and reading, she just blossomed. And by grade 7, I think Stu and I spent a lot of time negotiating with her to spend time with her friends during break because she was constantly in a book. Mm. And I think that had a large impact, actually, on her, that amount of reading, on her intellect, on the way she thought. But by grade 7, she really started to grow into herself.
How old was she when you first realized something wasn't right and that you were going to need medical intervention?
So Jen was completely healthy and a dancer and swimming, very healthy. And then at 16, she was gorgeous and young and we were on the beach and she was sort of having her first holiday of noticing the boys. And we got a very, very tragic phone call from Stuart's sister, his younger sister, to say that her daughter, Natalie, had been diagnosed with a rare form of cancer, chordoma. And it was shortly after that that I started to notice that Jen was breathless. And we initially thought that it was related to anxiety, but she was never an anxious person. It soon became clear that it wasn't anxiety. And so started this terrible search for what was actually wrong, for a diagnosis. And that took a long time. It took 18 months to get a proper diagnosis, which was part of the problem, because by the time we had a proper diagnosis, she was so far gone.
So one of the things that has changed for so many people because of your sharing of Jenna's story is that more doctors are alert to the condition she suffered from, which we'll talk about now. There is a sense of heightened awareness that this condition exists, and if somebody is presenting with these kinds of symptoms, this is one of the things that should be checked. That did not exist before, Jenna. For you, there was no one to say, have you heard of pulmonary arterial hypertension? Has somebody checked for it? And as you say, that meant that by the time you finally got to that diagnosis, a lot more damage had already been done to her lungs. She was further along the path than she might otherwise have been. Had you ever even heard of the disease when the doctors uttered those words to you?
Gosh, no. I mean, I'd heard the word hypertension, and you think of that as high blood pressure. I'd never heard the word pulmonary hypertension or pulmonary arterial hypertension. And initially, it sounded, so she had been, we noticed from the scan that she had lots of blood clots in her lungs, and that's what we thought it was. And pulmonary hypertension sounded to me like a better option. But I didn't know what it was. And then soon we started to do the reading and realized that it certainly was not a better option. Pulmonary hypertension is high blood pressure in the veins and arteries of the lungs only. The rest of the body is completely normal and fine. And you get different, lots of different kinds of pulmonary hypertension. You get primary or arterial, which is very serious illness. And you get secondary pulmonary hypertension, also serious, but as a result of something else, some underlying condition. And that form of pulmonary hypertension is much slower, can be treated more easily. But it took a lot of reading and a lot of prodding around to really work out what was going on.
Mm. When you got that diagnosis, you had a real challenge on your hands, not only in terms of the medical fight that had to be fought, but you had the challenge of knowing that you had this incredibly bright, incredibly articulate, deep thinker of a daughter. And some children might have been satisfied with the term, this is what you have and this is what we're going to do to fight it. But your daughter was not somebody who would take it lying down. You knew what she was like. You would have known that she would go and start reading up and researching. Talk to us about balancing in those early days, because you must have known she would be tempted to do that. You must have known what she would find if she did that reading, and you must have wanted to keep her safe from it, even if just for a little bit longer.
You're touching on something that was very raw and very, very tough, because, yes, that was exactly it, that in knowledge there's power, but, of course, we really wanted to protect her from this. Initially, she followed the doctor's instructions, which were, please, Jen, don't Google, because there's so much information out there, and it's such a complex disease that you won't know what you're reading. And initially, she did follow that. We didn't. We were reading and learning up all the time. But obviously, there came a time when she did. And I talk about it in the book. It was one of the most heartbreaking days ever for me. She wasn't well. She'd been down to school. She was by then on a mobility scooter and on full-time oxygen. And my phone, which I kept with me all the time, rang, and it was her number. And I picked up the phone, and she just said, "Mom," and I could hear she was weeping. And I was, what? And she said, "I Googled." And yeah, just flew down the road to fetch her. It was the start of the reality of her knowing that she was going to die young started that day. She Googled, she knew, she took it in. We got home, she walked down the passage, she closed the bedroom door, and she journaled for an hour. And then I went in and I climbed into bed with her, and we drank tea and we just held each other and wept. It was very tough.
It's a tough section of the book to read, to imagine being in her shoes and in yours that day. We don't have to imagine, though, what she was thinking, because she did leave a diary, and we'll talk a little bit later about the decision to include some excerpts of that diary in this book. But I want to read for our audience a few of Jenna's words that she wrote, and this is an entry from the 21st of May, 2012, written at home in her bedroom as the realization sank in of what she was facing. And she wrote the following: "I'm lucky if I have 10 years left. No long life for me, no career, no opportunity to change things, no kids. Because even if I last double that, 20 years, at 37 I would still die while my kids are young, and that's not fair to them. And who wants a mother who can't take them hiking or play ball or even prepare them dinner? I will not get better before I get worse. Never again will I run, jump, or swim in the ocean. I've never learned to surf. I will never ski or scuba dive. I have to cling to the hope that medical experts will develop a cure." And she goes on to write about all the things that she longed to still do and still achieve. And it is a remarkable list. It is a long list. And I have no doubt that she would have ticked off all of these items had she had the time.
Oh, she would have.
From the wildly adventurous to the lighthearted, wanting to go to a matric dance, wanting to go on matric rage, to wanting to make a difference in the world and change people's lives. And, of course, she has done that.
She has done that.
And we will talk in more detail about how. But let's just talk about that list. And, Stu, let me bring you in here, because all dads want to protect their daughters and keep them safe for as long as they can. To have a daughter who longed to do all these things but was physically at risk while doing them must have been incredibly difficult. And yet you guys made a really conscious effort, and Gabby writes about it in the book, to create joy, to create those moments and allow her to do as much as she could, even if it had to be adapted. Why was it so important to you that she have those experiences?
I think it's like a lot of the things that we did with Jen were driven by the way she was. She was just always so hopeful and always so positive and always so grateful for what she did have. And she was pretty forceful. You know, when she set her mind to doing something, it would typically happen. So the complexity came in where we decided to do things. If we just went for a simple outing to go for, you know, down the road for a pet or something, it was oxygen and pumps and hours of preparation and typically asleep in the afternoon and rushing back at the right time for meds. So everything, you know, that's a tiny example. And the bigger the thing, obviously, the bigger the planning was. So when Gabs went to Plet Rage with Jenna, it was a military operation that had, you know, 1,000 moving parts, because if anything went wrong, it was potentially catastrophic for her. But the driver of it all the way through Jenna's whole life was this, like, incredible zest for life, this incredible drive, this incredible... She was the one that led us to find the joy, to find meaningful connections with people. You know, people used to come, you know, people from these stations used to come and sit with Jenna at the bottom of their bed for 20 minutes and leave, like, seriously impacted by this young brain. You know, she just had incredibly inquisitive, incredibly inquiring, sharp mind. And a lot of the stuff that she wanted to do was fickle and fun, but a lot of the stuff that she really wanted to do was meaningful stuff about affecting social change. So those are the real sadnesses, I suppose. And what Gabs has done and what we've done through the Jenna Lowe Trust, I think, is the legacy work that she would have done. But definitely, as you're saying, there's a sense that she would have made a dent in the universe on her own. Yeah.
Well, she already did.
Yeah.
I just want to backtrack to those fears that were expressed in the first part of that diary entry. Gabby, I got a sense reading the many diary entries, and I think it's wonderful that you included them, and we can talk after the headlines about the decision to do that, but there was a sense that she was keeping it all to herself and not wanting to share those fears with anybody else, not because she couldn't communicate with you or because she didn't trust you, but because she wanted to protect you, because she knew, as much as she was afraid, she could see what you were going through as her parents. I know it was several years before you read those diary entries. What was it like for you to realize that, and at some point that did shift where she realized she had to lean on you?
So it did shift, but let's start with the first question. The first time I read those journal entries, those diaries, was 3 years after she died, when I sat down to write the book. I had put, a whole lot of stuff into a box, and I opened the box. And I think it's a really important thing to do when you're grieving. It's a metaphor for you really need to look in the box. And I read her diary. It was excruciatingly painful, and yet it was also really beautiful to have her jumping off the page, to hear her voice. I felt like she was all around me. And what I can say that is, in the beginning, she was very private about the difficult stuff, and she did not want to share it with her friends. She wanted to protect them from how difficult it was for her, and she wanted to make it easy for them to be with her. She didn't want to miss. She already felt other because she was on oxygen and on a mobility scooter, and she just wanted it to be easy for them. But there did come a time where it became just too hard, and she started to open up to me. And Stuart will remember those many nights where I would climb into bed with her, and I literally would come through the room at 1 or 2 in the morning, and she would just talk and talk. I think it was one of the hardest parts of all of us, was holding that as a mother. Just being there and holding that was incredibly painful, because I didn't know if I could change it.
This forced you into a role as a medical activist, and again, we'll speak about that after the news headline break. I just want to share with you a message that's come through on our SMS line that simply reads, Gabby and Stuart, you give hope to many in the face of immense sadness. A belated happy birthday to you, Stu, from friends from Hermanus, whoever they may be. Thank you so much for that message. And if anybody else would like to say something or ask a question or perhaps reflect on the legacy of the Get Me to 21 campaign and the fight for access to treatment of pulmonary hypertension in South Africa, you are very welcome to do an SMS to 31567 or leave a voice note on 072-567-1567. There are moments, this is a sad book, we know it has a sad ending, everybody knows that going in, but it is a book full of moments where you unexpectedly laugh out loud and find those moments of joy that you were trying so hard to create for Jenna. I was so delighted. She got to go to the matric dance. She got to write her matric exam. She did brilliantly. She was in the top, micro percentage of the province. She got to do the drama pracs. The school made a huge effort to make sure she could continue to come to school for as long as she could each day and access the facilities. And her courage in doing that was such a big lesson, I think, to everybody who watched it, because she could so easily have said, well, I'm too tired to go to school. I can't manage more than 2 hours, so I might as well not go. Yeah. She had quite the opposite response, didn't
she? Quite the opposite response. She was very angry with herself if there was a day she couldn't go. Most days she didn't go for a full day because she couldn't. But every day she insisted on going for a while. And she often used to remark on that, on how so many of the kids her age were finding ways to miss school, and all she wanted was to be at school and to be with her friends and to be learning and to be reading. But just the other day, I heard the most wonderful story of a varsity student who, when she was up on campus, which we will discuss, I'm sure, later, was sitting in a tutorial, and the teacher who was leading the tutorial was just really battling to get the students to talk, which sometimes happens in TUTs, I'm told. And eventually just put down the subject and said, you know what, guys, okay, let's just have a discussion. What motivates you? What really motivates you? And there was this long silence. And then one student said, there's a young girl on campus. I don't know who she is, and I don't know what's wrong with her. But she's on a mobility scooter and on oxygen and with these pumps all over the place. And every time I see her, her hair's blowing back in the wind and she's smiling at everybody. That motivates me.
And that was Jenna.
And that was Jen.
Lunch with Pippa Hudson on Cape Talk. Join the conversation.
We're back in conversation with Gabby and Stuart Lowe, the parents of Jenna Lowe. And Gabby's book, Get Me to 21, The Jenna Lowe Story, describes in brutal detail the fight to save their daughter's life, a fight which was ultimately not successful for them, but which has been a game changer for so many other patients. And in the second half hour, we are going to talk about the aspect of organ donation and much more. But let me just share with you a message that's come in on our WhatsApp line from Lynn, who writes the following. Gabby and Stuart, what you have been through is unimaginable. Thank you for giving Jenna's story to the world through your activism and through this book. Your family will continue to touch many lives and affect change for PH sufferers everywhere. Let's talk about the why of the book, Gabby, because it can't have been easy to write. I know it was agonizing for you to go through the process of reliving this story, but why was it so important to you?
So there are many reasons for that. The first is that when Jen was in ICU and all those days, months that I spent sitting at her bedside, she told Stuart and I that she wanted to write a book when she came out. She was going to write this book herself. So part of me wanted to honor that and was very nervous. Was I ever going to do it well enough? Because she was such a beautiful writer. The second reason is that I really believed that this story and how much was impacted through her was important for that to be shared with the world, because we don't realize the impact we can have. One small thing that we do can have a massive impact for other people. So that became really important. The other reason was that for me, I knew it would be part of my healing. Mm. And it was. It was excruciating. I think it's one of the most painful things I've ever done, other than sit in ICU for 187 days. It was the most painful thing I've ever done. And yet, I can honestly tell you that I feel lighter. Mm. I feel lighter. And so it has just shown me that in order to really learn to live with loss and trauma, you can't run away from the reality. You cannot run away from the pain. You have to learn to integrate it into your life. You have to learn to integrate it.
There is perhaps a response there to Simone, who has SMSed the following, to say, a remarkable family on every level. Gabby, Stu, Christy, and Jenna, you impact on all of us in the most profound way. Your resilience in the face of unthinkable grief is a lesson for all of us. For those who are grieving, what are a few of the things that helped you in those early days after Jenna died?
So the early days, I can honestly say, I barely remember. I felt like a ghost of myself. But what I do remember is being absolutely cocooned by the most incredible circle of support of friends and family. One of the hardest things we ever did in our journey was really reach out. To reach out and make the story public, which we had to do in order to build a profile for Jen in order to get the meds into the country, was one of the hardest things to do, because it makes us feel so vulnerable to ask for help. I'd far rather give help than receive help. And I think most of us feel that way. And yet what we learned is that in asking for help, you do give help, because it's a virtuous circle. Giving is receiving and receiving is giving, and the impact that she's had on everybody else pays forward all the time, all the time. So when she died, that love really, really helped, but mostly just having Stuart and Christy at my side was, I don't know how we would have gotten through without each other. I don't know.
We have hopped a little bit ahead in the story, and it's an important piece we've hopped over that I want to come back to, because you reached a point where you had a diagnosis, you knew the prognosis was not good, and you immediately looked for, well, what can we do to intervene? What therapies are available? And you found one.
Yes, one out of 18.
Available.
So
in this
for
pulmonary
hypertension, there are 18 different therapies and 3 different pathways to treatment, and one drug was available in South Africa. Entry-level drug, that was it.
Which did very little for Jen.
For Jen. We tried her. We had her on the maximum dose almost immediately, and it didn't make much difference at all. So we had to find a way. And the only way to do that was to really become activists, to say, well, no, we won't take no for an answer. What are the barriers to entry? What do we have to do? And so we had to find and learn and fill in forms and fight with Medical Control Council and get Section 21A approval and raise the funds and start fundraising so we could afford the medication, find a pharmaceutical company who would bring it in and import it for us, get the approvals, get it here in time, keep getting it back again, because they'd only send it for 3 months. Well, that's no good, because you can't go off it. And so we got sort of catapulted into this world of that I'd never dreamt I'd be in, of really having to fight for what she needed, and in so doing, fighting for everybody else. And all these people started crawling out of the woodwork and finding the way to us and saying, I have pulmonary hypertension, or I think I have pulmonary hypertension, or my sister or my brother has pulmonary hypertension. And so we started banding all these people together. Now, in South Africa, there are probably 5 different treatments available for PH patients. And
so
of course,
you've
the clinic.
Made progress, but there is a long way to go.
There's a long, long way to go.
The
still.
Clinic at Groote Schuur. I'm very sorry that the doctors couldn't be with us today to join the conversation to talk a little bit about that. But I know that's been a game changer for so many patients.
It has been. So we started a clinic called the Jenelo Trust Clinic at pulmonary hypertension clinic at Groote Schuur, and there are about 120 state patients at that clinic.
Fantastic. You did reach a point, well, first let's talk about the Flowland, because one of the interim steps before you went onto the transplant list and to keep her going while you waited on a transplant was this drug Flowland. And the description in the book, I want to sigh at the very thought of what it took, because every day it was an hour plus of mixing. And how many stages in that process to get that drug ready?
35-step sterile process to mix the drug every single morning.
And it was a drug that had to be continuously fed through a tube into a port. She could not be without it. Once she had started taking it, she could never stop taking it.
Yeah.
And there was a 3.5-minute window if anything went wrong for you to get a new replacement pump going.
Yeah. It was very scary. It was very scary. But the truth was, by then she was so bad, and we had to bridge her to transplant. And we were also hoping that the Flowland, which is an IV intravenous epoprostenol, would buy her much longer before needing transplant, because lung transplants are not forever. And so we really needed to try and extend her life. And many patients across the world who are on Flolan can live for 10, 15 years before they need a transplant. But then they get onto it early. For her, it didn't work out like that because she got onto it so late. But we really had to bring it into the country. We had to. There was no choice. But I don't think I realized just how hectic it was going to be. We did find doctors all over the world who helped us, and Professor Bradesh flew over from the States with his nurse practitioner to help us to do the port, to help us to teach us how to administer this medication. But in truth, myself, Stuart, and Nurse Lizzie were the only 3 people on the continent who knew how to do it. So even when she went in for her transplant, Nurse Lizzie had to go in with her to surgery so that she could stop the pump so that the surgery could carry on. Wow. And before that as well, we had a problem with the line once. We had to go in. We had to be with her all of the time because we were the only people who knew how to mix this medication. And it's a bit like working with chemotherapy. It's toxic, highly toxic. And, 3.5-minute half-life, which really means if that's all the time you've got and if something goes wrong, you put her life at risk.
Now, we have to share the story of one of the somethings that went wrong. You did not. I was not expecting to laugh as loudly as I did reading this book, but the particular chapter, of all the things that you think might have happened, you might have thought that it accidentally was dislodged by somebody bumping her, or on campus somebody bumped the scooter and it came wrong. A bunny eating through the line was not a plot twist that I ever saw coming. Gabby, please share with us that story.
Oh, my heavens. So our beautiful younger daughter is an absolute animal fanatic, and when things get tough, we somehow end up with more animals. I don't know, more dogs, more bunnies, more everything. And Christy bought 2 very beautiful white bunnies, which we loved, and they became house bunnies. They went between the garden and the house, and this one day, Jen was far gone, and she was on her pump, and she was trying to get from the lounge to the bedroom, and just that distance was tough for her. So she stopped off halfway along to Christy's bedroom, lay down on the bed next to Christy. They were chatting, and she put her pump down on the floor. And 2 minutes later, I heard this scream from Christy, "Mom!" Oh, my God, I'll never forget. Went racing through, and there she was holding this line, and it was severed. And I'd said, "What? What happened?" And Jen just went, "Bunny." And that was it. We had to get to that drug den. We called it the drug den, the room where we mixed all the medication. She had fabulous nicknames for all her oxygen scooter and a tank and whatever. down into that drug den and change this thing. I had 3.5 minutes. I had Christy, and my eyes were this size and shaking, and Christy saying, "Mom, concentrate. What must I do? What must I do?" And I'm passing her things, and with masks on and gloves on, and oh my God. And we eventually get that new pump on, and Christy and I are shaking, and the phone rings. And I don't know why I answered it. I looked at the phone. It's Radio 702, because Jen was supposed to be having a live interview that night. And I said, "Don't worry, Jen, don't worry. I'll just tell them that you're busy." She said, "Don't be ridiculous." Took the phone and said, "Hello, thank you so much for having me on the show." That was it. She never mentioned to them what had just happened. Christy and I left in an absolute state, and she went straight on to have a live interview on air. Unbelievable.
Now, that's 3.5 minutes, okay, so think about what that means. It means you can never effectively be more than a few minutes away from Jenna. You were by her side all the time. Stuart, I see you nodding, I think, in recognition of the support that Gabby gave and how tough she was. You had a plan for everything and every eventuality, including Operation O2, a list that ran to several pages of what was going to happen. Not if, but when you got the phone call to say that lungs were there. And all the processes and what had to be taken and packed, because as you said, moving from point A to point B was not hop in the car and let's go.
No.
Murphy's Law, the one weekend you decide, I'm taking a break to be with Christy and plait for her plait rage, that was the weekend the call came through. And the book opens with your description of Stuart phoning to say, "Gabby, we've got lungs." Before we speak to Gabby, I mean, Stuart, what was it like for you to get that call?
It wasn't ideal. the whole plan relied on Gabs being there, and Jenna obviously being in the right place at the right time with the right people in support of her.
Mm.
So the family sort of had to be together for the plan to work, and for Gabs to have left town to go up to Plett to be with Christy at a really special time for her was like a big decision, which we didn't take lightly. And so that morning, Operation O2 had, I don't know how many steps were in the process, maybe 35 or 40 different steps that we had negotiated with the organ transplant coordinators to say, no, we won't move the whole family up to Joburg to preempt the transplant and wait, because they said, if you're going to wait, you know, the only place they did lung transplants was in Johannesburg. So we said, please, can we stay in Cape Town with the family awaiting transplant? We promise we can get to Johannesburg within 4 hours. And they said, well, how the hell are you going to do that? And then we said, okay, well, we built a design, mm-hmm. and we shared it with them. So it involved obviously getting Jen out of bed, onto her medication, and packed up with everything that was pre-prepared for that, getting in the car, and then most crucially finding a private aircraft because she couldn't fly privately. The time just didn't arrive for it.
Mm.
So my business partner Brandon and I were sitting 9 o'clock in the morning. The phone rings at 10 past. Jenna hears the phone ring and thinks that's a bit weird. She was awake because it was time to mix drugs. And then my cell phone rings 2 minutes later, and she goes, "Hold on a second." A landline and a phone back to back that time of the morning.
Something.
And she
weird.
Had a sense, and the nurse came through to me and said, there's a call for you. And it was Angela, the transplant coordinator, and she said, how fast can you get to Johannesburg? So the first thing I did was phone Gabby. Gabby had, she was 6 hours away up the coast, literally a million miles away from where she needed to be to help Jen. Fortunately, Jenna's nurse was close by, so we could do everything that Jenna needed to happen, but this aeroplane was the big issue. And we phoned, and a very close friend of ours had said, look, you can use my plane on demand. The aeroplane wasn't there. And I hung up on the call, and I thought, okay, the whole plan's out the window. We're just not going to get our child to Johannesburg in time. And he very kindly got on the phone to a couple of pilots and said, you have to find out what jets are on the ground in Cape Town. We have to take one of those. And that landed up with a person that we don't even know offering their jet, and two pilots who were about to paddle out on their surf skis at Blouberg, who took calls and said, guys, you know, if you can you just skip this morning's paddle and get to the airport? And long story short, by the time those two guys in their shorts got to the bottom of somebody else's Learjet, we were there with Jenna, her nurse, her boyfriend, Christy, and literally ran up the stairs, pulled the steps up, and we were 65,000 foot within an hour.
Wow. I mean, the extraordinary part of the story, another extraordinary part of the story, I should say, is those complete strangers who said, of course we're going to help, we'll be there,
yeah,
took one look at Jenna's boyfriend who was trying desperately to say goodbye, yeah, and said, no, we actually can't watch this, get on the plane, you're coming with us, we will bring you home later. Yeah. I mean, I got such goosebumps reading that chapter. Gabby, you were hours away in a house full of teenagers
who had just come to the end of their 2 weeks of plet rage. Heavens. And I literally ran down the passage, screamed, Christy, we've got lungs, we've got to be in the car. 10 minutes later, we were in the car. Threw the car keys, my friend Jilly took me to the airport, threw the car keys at these teenagers and said, lock up the house, take my trailer, take my car, we're out of here. They were all staring at me with these huge eyes. We flew off to the George Airport, only to discover there was a massive storm in Johannesburg and all the planes were grounded. And there was not one plane on the runway. And I can promise you that because I would have hijacked it if there was. Not one plane on the runway. And Christy and I sat at that airport. She was the color of a white sheet and she never spoke the entire day. We sat waiting for 6 hours to get on a plane to Johannesburg. I cannot begin to describe to you what that felt like.
And when you got to Johannesburg, you then sat for 8 hours of surgery, yeah, waiting. If I may, I'm going to ask Samantha Nichols to very quickly step up, and I'm putting her on the spot, but I've seen her in the audience, and she is the executive director of the Organ Donor Foundation, and I'm not going to miss the opportunity to bring her to a microphone and just pause for a second to reflect on that phone call saying, we've got lungs. They were very lucky to get that call, Samantha, weren't they? Let's just get the microphone on if we can, because the odds were not stacked in their favor.
Yes, absolutely. So with many patients, we see, firstly, many patients being turned away from dialysis facilities in the state sector. There aren't enough facilities to help patients. And also, we've seen kids at Red Cross who just don't make it in time. They literally, my colleague, your little boy, had a transplant, a kidney liver transplant, and I've been with him many times to Red Cross, and I've seen the children that literally die in front of you. So, you know, this call, obviously, we weren't sure if it was going to happen. I remember we've worked with the family for quite a long time. So when we heard that, you know, they'd made the call and the lungs were there, we were extremely excited for Jenna and her family.
We haven't really spoken much about the Get Me to 21 campaign, which you started. It was not only about finding lungs for Jenna. It was about Jenna realizing the numbers are low. There are far too few people registered as organ donors in South Africa, and there are so many people like me waiting. We've got to help recruit more people. She launched that famous campaign. That video went viral overnight.
Yes.
Thousands upon thousands of people signed up, myself included. I'm one of them. Samantha, it was a game changer. It brought so many new names onto the registry, but we're still so far from where we need to be.
Absolutely. We need every single South African to register as an organ donor. We need education on the grassroots levels. We really need, we find that a lot of people know about organ donation. We've done lots of surveys, about 80% of people know or they've heard about transplantation, but it's taking that next step, registering as an organ donor, talking to your family. It's so important to discuss the decision more than actually registering. It's important to talk to your family about organ and tissue donation. So a lot of people don't want to think about their death, you know, or apathetic, it doesn't affect them directly. But meeting a lot of people working in the environment that I do, I actually see so many people that come forward that say, I know someone that needs a transplant, I know someone that's on dialysis. So it affects so many people, thousands of people, and thousands can't even make it onto the waiting list because there aren't enough transplants in South Africa.
Right, so I'm going to close this interview with the website details and hope that people listening are going to go straight to that site and register. Samantha, thank you. Really putting her on the spot. She hadn't been invited to be part of the panel today, but I saw her and thought we've got to hear from the Organ Donor Foundation while they're with us. Just the latest stats, which one of your wonderful team of doctors shared with me before this interview, was that the latest stats are for the year 2017. There were 91 consented solid organ donors donations in South Africa. It's just not high enough.
It's not good enough. There are 5,000 people a day waiting for a transplant.
Now, you were the lucky ones who got lungs. Jenna died with a healthy pair of lungs. She had terrible complications after the surgery, which could not have been foreseen. And I'm not going to dwell on the agonizing 187 days that you spent in ICU after that op. It is there in the book, warts and all. Incredibly harrowing to read. What amazes me, Gabby, is to read how you came through that, because you put all that time and love and support. Jen didn't make it. You had to go home and face a life without her, and look to Stuart and look to her sister Christy, and love each other and support each other through that darkest moment. Mm-hmm. So many people would have felt so angry. There are stories in the book of lapses in medical care, lapses in nursing. Many families would have lashed out, would have sued, would have looked for someone to blame. You don't appear to have done that, or maybe you've got past the point of feeling like you wanted to do that by the time you wrote this book, because you must have had anger.
I had enormous anger, and I can't say that I didn't have moments of really thinking about that. But at the end of the day, I was well aware that nothing that we did would bring her back. And you don't heal with anger. You don't heal. Mm. Also, I think what really shifted for me, and I didn't write this book until I had processed my anger on purpose. On purpose. Because I think what I really kind of shifted it for me was that the doctors and the nurses' intentions were never to harm her. The system is greatly at fault. There are gaps in the care. There are gaps in handovers. There are nurses working outrageous hours with no support. And there are doctors working outrageous hours with no support. And so I think there are major errors in the system. And I could write another whole book about that. Mm. But I knew, Stuart knew, Christy knew, we all knew we had to find a way to let go of the anger so that we could move forward and continue to make a difference to other people's lives. You don't do that if you hang on to your bitterness and your anger.
Well, I just want to share with you some of the people who are being impacted by this interview who are sending in messages to us. One message is a WhatsApp from Elka saying, I was on the waiting list for a kidney for 5 years without success until my partner decided to donate his. We are blessedly both well and celebrating our kidneyversary next week. Elka, congratulations.
Wonderful.
I love the term. But there again is somebody who waited and didn't get that call and had to find another way to make it happen. Another message from Yusta listening saying on the SMS line, it is so hard for me to listen to you as I have lived through similar to you for so many years. Fortunately, my boy is alive today, and I cannot express my gratitude for his donor. Thank you, Gabby and Stuart, for your wonderful work. Your family and Jenna made such a huge difference to transplants in South Africa. I mean, you must be able to look back with pride at the impact that the Get Me to 21 campaign had, that your advocacy has had for other patients with pulmonary hypertension, because we're not just talking about heightened awareness, 5 drugs available instead of 1. Next year, there's a huge pulmonary hypertension conference happening in South Africa.
Yes, there is. Yeah. It'll be the first one ever, an international PH conference in South Africa. And then we are hosting, the General Trust is hosting a meeting in Cape Town from the patient's perspective, which I think is really, really important.
Really hugely important. I mean, dramatic, measurable breakthroughs, thousands more added to the donor list. But for you, a very personal loss and grief that you've dealt with such grace, and I think which has inspired so many people listening today and watching your family story. The one question that's been asked by so many people and gets asked every time I mention this book is, how is Christy? And Stuart, maybe you want to chat to us, because Christy, Jenna's younger sister, she was herself only a teenager watching this family, your whole family, go through this. She lost her beloved older sister. She was with you through the trauma and the fear and the stress of those days and the days in ICU. What has it been like for her to come to terms with not having her sister in her life anymore?
She's sick today. She really should have been here to answer. Mm. I would have loved to have heard her answer to that question. But she was incredibly close to Jen. They had a very special relationship. And what happened to Christy happened at the worst possible time for a young woman, time-wise. You know, she was 13. She was just becoming a young lady. And effectively, her youth was stolen from her because, first of all, she lost her parents because we became completely fixated with doing everything we could for Jen. Mm. And obviously so aware of Jenna, of Christy and what she needed, but The truth is we were locked in a glass box for 6 months, and for some of that time, Christy chose to stay in Cape Town, so she was, you know, she fended for herself a lot of that time. But I think, you know, we had to talk about the book, and I think what Gabby's done by writing the story for herself and for me and for Christy is a phenomenal gift. You know, it's just to have just the size and shape of it, and the degree of the trauma was so different, so difficult to comprehend before it was laid out as Gabby's done in the book. And for all of us, and I think Christy particularly, where if you read the book, Christy is so present in Gabby's heart and her mind, and mine, and Jen's, and that in every single page of the book.
Absolutely.
It's where's Christy, and how is Christy? And the truth is, it was brutal for her. And the year after Jen died, it was really hard for all of us to be functional. And, you know, part of our journey was just respecting that our responses were so radically different. Yeah. Gabby's incredibly brave in the face of pain. You know, me, I'd rather go to work and pretend it wasn't so painful for a bit. And Christy had a lie down for a year, you know. It was hard to come back. So very different responses. And now I think with the help of the book and a lot of the brave processes that we've kind of decided to embark on, she's pretty healed and pretty solid, with a lot of hard lessons under her belt for a beautiful young child that I think will evolve her into an extraordinary young woman. And you wouldn't take the pain, but there's some silver lining in that.
Yeah.
She's an incredible young person now.
What a beautiful high note on which to finish a conversation. I wish I had another hour with you. Yeah. I need to say two things. One, if anybody listening is in any doubt, I hope you're not in any doubt any longer, please just go and visit the Organ Donor Foundation website, odf.org.za. Debbie has messaged saying, I'm about to donate a kidney to my son on Tuesday. Listening in awe to these incredible parents has reaffirmed my decision. So good luck to you, Debbie, and your son, and good luck to the whole Lowe family. I hope everyone is going to buy the book, Get Me to 21. It is an extraordinary book. Gabby, you've done a beautiful job of writing the story and sharing Jenna's legacy with the world. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time and sharing it with us today. Gabby and Stuart Lowe, wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you, Papa.